Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Aarti Shahani's story embodies the American dream. A first-generation Indian-American, Aarti journeyed from her working-class neighborhood in Queens, New York, to a scholarship at one of the country's most elite prep schools, then the University of Chicago, and then Harvard, led her to an NPR byline covering the world's biggest tech companies. But within her own family lies the great paradox of America's immigration system. The Shahanis first lived in the United States as undocumented immigrants. The fragility of that early experience was impressed upon her at a very young age. But Shahani says that greater security did not come when her family got their green cards. A few accidental missteps landed her father in prison, the fear of deportation hanging over him. The fragility of that experience forever changed him and changed Shahani's family. So this hour on Point, Aarti Shahani's American dreams and American nightmares. And you can join us if you are a green card holder right now. Do you feel secure in your place in American society? Or has someone you know who is a green card holder, someone in your family perhaps, been deported? How did that impact you and your loved ones? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Aarti Shahani joins us today from New York. You have heard her reporting, most definitely. She's an NPR correspondent based in Silicon Valley. Her new memoir is Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Aarti, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. I first of all want to ask you if, when you decided to write this book about your family and particularly about your father, did you have any hesitation in writing it, given sort of the great controversies that the nation is experiencing about immigration right now?
The hesitation came in the years before I finally decided I was going to write it. There was a lot of hesitation. You know, like, I had spent my life pretty much from age 16 to 30 with my father's legal problems constantly hanging over our heads. You know, you already gave a great summary of my family's trajectory into America. Once we got here and we thought that we were established here, Dad opened up a store. He actually opened up a small business on the exact same street where he used to shovel snow for $4 an hour. So, you know, I was achieving my dream, being a precocious kid in school, and he was his own business owner, small business owner. One day, Dad got arrested. He was at Rikers Island, and apparently he had sold watches and calculators to the Cali drug cartel. Yeah. It was shocking. I was, as a kid, interested in becoming a prosecutor, so I was actually ashamed of Dad. I didn't know how to wrap my head around my ideals of justice and what my father had been accused of. And then what slowly happened over the years, this was by no means immediate, what slowly happened was that, well, Dad agreed to take a guilty plea because his lawyer urged him to. The 8-month sentence, it was supposed to be 8 months and he was supposed to put the matter behind him. It ended up spiraling into legal problems that lasted until I was 30. And I basically grew up in the shadow of a legal case that would not go away and that seemed determined to destroy my family. And I wanted to keep my family together.
Yeah. Well, if I may, I mean, just we can slow down a little bit here because we have an hour. And I do want I mean, the beauty of your book is the detail with which you tell this story because it's a true – it's a true it's a true glimpse into the story of an American family that is lived by millions of people here. So let's go back. Let's go back to the start. Okay, what first brought your family to the United States?
By the way, you sound like my dad telling me to slow down.
I am.
Thank you. What brought us here? You know, I did not know the real story of why we came here until I stopped to write this memoir. And I asked Mom, hey, you and Dad would always say we came here for a better life for you kids. What does that even mean? And it always kind of made no sense to me because while my family is originally from India, I was born in Morocco and we had a relatively stable life there. So I thought, why would my parents leave relative stability and come to America and choose to live undocumented with three children? I thought that was crazy. I mean, you know, that is a lot of risk. And
they,
Mom
they came,
told me.
They came originally on a tourist visa, right?
Correct. Okay. We came on tourist visas, which we overstayed. I was an infant or a toddler at the time. And Mom told me, and I had never known this before, that she apparently back home was dealing with a really, really difficult extended family situation. She didn't call it abuse, and that's not a word that was really in circulation at the time that she was going through it. But they lived in what many of us will know is a joint family with many extended relatives. And Mom and Dad loved each other a lot. And my father was a gentleman, but not everyone in the clan was. And something pretty horrible happened. And my mom tried to take her own life. She swallowed pills. She didn't want to wake up again. I didn't know this before. I didn't know that my mom attempted suicide. And I have to tell you, when she told me, it shocked me because my mom is one of the most resilient human beings I know. Mm-hmm. So to learn that she had reached that level of desperation was incredibly painful. She came back to... eventually, my father agreed that they would take the family and come to America because coming to America was easier than moving across the street in some ways.
Wow. I just wanted to say that there's so many parts of your story that I kind of intrinsically feel like I understand because my parents are obviously immigrants from India as well. And there's something about what it takes – sort of the fortitude and the resilience that it takes to be an immigrant, right? To leave everything you know that's familiar, even when it's very, very hard, that familiarity is full of hard and dark things, to come to another country. Because I just feel like it makes sense to me that you didn't know these things before. Because there's a lot that I didn't know about my parents because for 40 years, 45 years, they were so focused on making their lives here as Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think that's the tricky thing about how trauma works, right?
Yeah.
Because there is so much to be learned in the pain that we go through and the trials that we face, but they're hard to talk about. And so they often get lost. So I think in part it's our parents or our own lives. We're so busy trying to make it. But in part, it's just painful to revisit.
Yeah. Well, and when you in growing up in Queens, your mother was, I mean, like you said, she was very resilient and incredibly active also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My parents actually together, they spoke six languages or six and a half languages, you could say, though they lacked formal education. You know, my mom just finished grade school, but she is a sponge for languages. And when we landed in Queens, which, you know, was one of the most diverse zip codes on earth when I was growing up, 11355. I'm incredibly proud of it. I remember growing up and there was Beverly Hills 90210 and that became like a button. And I was like, nah, 11355. That's the real deal. But, you know, basically, we were a working class United Nations, every nationality represented. Mom could speak to a lot of them, and she basically became an organizer without even calling it that or knowing that it was that. She helped, for example, Central American day laborers and the leaders of a Hindu temple get along with each other because the Hindu temple didn't like the day laborers standing on the corner waiting for work. And she could speak each of their language and help them to get each other. And she did amazing work. That is, you know, a footnote in most people's lives, but a prominent factor in mine.
Well, so tell us more about your dad then, because he left India first when he was just barely in his teens, right?
Yeah. You know, my father was unfortunately fated to start life over and over and over again. It's funny, but, you know, some of us believe in reincarnation. And I feel like Dad had to keep reliving life over and over in this one time he was given. He was uprooted from his home as a child. In 1947, there was a horrifically violent partition of India and Pakistan when the British decided to leave the subcontinent that they'd colonized. They left very haphazardly, quickly. Horrific violence ensued, and millions of people had to leave their homes. My father, as well as my mother, were among them. Dad was old enough to remember it as a child. After his family fled from their native Karachi down into India, Karachi now being in Pakistan, Dad, by the time he was a teenager, had to leave the subcontinent altogether to become a migrant worker in Beirut. So he worked in Beirut, Lebanon. He sent money back home to his family. He actually, I learned this when Dad was in jail at Rikers, which is where I really got to start knowing who my father was. He was not able to attend his own father's funeral because he had to keep working and being, you know, a continent away to support his family. And from Beirut, he traveled around Northern Africa and the Middle East. My mom and dad met in Casablanca, where I and my siblings were born, and then we came over here. And it's just what I say. It's like every time when you're a migrant, you have to pick up and go and pick up and go and pick up and go. You're not seen for who you are in the new place that you come to. You're seen as an alien, as a foreigner, as an undeserving, as someone to be suspected in many cultures, not every. And so Dad was unfortunately forced to keep starting over. And I just know it in my steps. I appreciate how graciously you describe the steps I've taken in my own life. And I imagine, what would it look like for me if every time I wanted to make a pivot, people had no idea what my backstory was and it was irrelevant?
Well, we're talking this hour with Aarti Shahani. She has a new book out, a new memoir. It's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. It's the story, her immigration story, her family's immigration story in America. Of course, you know Aarti's work because she is NPR's correspondent from Silicon Valley as well. But when we come back, we'll hear a lot more about what happened to her father and how that shaped her family's life. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Aarti Shahani. She's NPR's correspondent in Silicon Valley. But we're talking with her this hour because of her new memoir. It's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And it is her family's immigration stories, the ups and the downs as well, and how even after securing green cards, there is a fragility to the immigrant experience that her family experienced. And we want to know what you think. If you're a green card holder right now, do you feel confident about your place in American society? Now, Aarti, when you were growing up, those early years in Queens, you weren't exactly living in the lap of luxury.
No, not at all.
Tell us a little bit about growing up there.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in apartment 401. That's how I remember it. That's what everyone called it. I lived in a building with over 100 units. We had a pretty crummy super who didn't do anything. Mom's first foray into organizing and making things better just started right at home because literally, you know, New York gets seriously cold in the winter and we wouldn't have heat and there wouldn't be hot water. The pipes would freeze. Things would break down. And, you know, Mom had a habit of talking to our neighbors and hearing out what other people were going through and bringing people together and, you know, trying to affect change. But yeah, no, I mean, it was a it sucked. It was small. It was dirty. I go back and I look at pictures of it and I'm like, wow, we really came from there. Yeah. You know, like I just look at it because it looked like we were under the thumb of a slumlord, you know. Mm-hmm. And you'd mentioned this and there are very few things I am afraid of out in the wild. Like I love the outdoors now. You know, from moving from New York to California, I totally took up nature. You know, ants don't scare me. Mosquitoes don't scare me. Bees don't scare me. But a roach, like the second I see even a baby roach, I freeze in terror. And I think it's because as a child, I mean, they were there everywhere I turned. Like everywhere I turned, they were everywhere. They show up inside the refrigerator. They show up on my leg. You know? Yeah. And it's actually funny, just to speak to the slumlord quality of the building, I went back in my research for the book just to – you know, when you get to write a memoir, you are revisiting your past and sometimes you have to go to places to see what they stir up in you, right? That sort of that digging deep. And I went to Flushing. I went to 401. I actually met a few of my old neighbors there, which was amazing. They didn't recognize me, but I recognized them. And I went to the mailbox room just outside the elevator, which is often broken. And I looked at the mailbox list and my family was still there.
Oh, wow. 401,
Shahani. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You guys can't fix a label. You know, that was my childhood home.
Or some things are indelible. How's that?
Sure.
But so how aware were you, or were there moments where you came into an awareness that your family didn't have the security of permanent residency status? I mean, did you know at a young age?
There, the main way I think I was aware of the fact that we didn't have papers. And I was. I mean, there was a fear I could see come up specifically. Actually, with other immigrants, okay, and this is a sort of key point that one must appreciate about the fear of being undocumented. Yes, there is a fear of police, for example. There is a fear that when NYPD would walk, Mom might cross the street. She recounted doing that. She recalled to me that she had done that. But what I specifically remember was, and I described this man in my book, there was this guy who was from our own ethnic community. And once we landed in America, he showed up. He happened to be a childhood friend of my father's from back home. And globalization and post-colonial reorganization of the world happened to fling them both in the same corner of Queens. The guy showed up and played hero. And he acted like he was going to help my parents a bunch. And then he ended up being a total con artist and taking them for a ride and making them terrified that he was going to call immigration on them because, hey, his family knew we didn't have papers. And that's what happens. I mean, a lot of people will relate to this. You know, there are threats from without. There are threats from within. And man, is it hard.
Yeah. But your family finally received green cards, though. And go ahead, please.
Yeah, we received green cards. We'd overstayed our tourist visas, and we received green cards actually through my aunt, my auntie Nimi, who is one of our saviors in this country. She and her husband had become U.S. citizens, and they sponsored us. And that's kind of what's funny to me also is my family, we got our green cards through a process that is called or is now derided as chain migration. And I just remember the first time I heard chain migration as some sort of like bad term, I thought to myself, huh, this is how misguided America has become, that a process that allows families to support each other and reunite and be stronger and grow together is now a negative thing. I'm like, we are really missing the forest for the trees here.
Yeah. But I mean, I have to ask, though, that there are many people, and in fact, I would say even even in the South Asian community here who mm-hmm. say you could look at your family story in a completely different light, that mm-hmm. they made your parents made choices to come here and overstay their tourist visa, which was a deliberate act to remain here illegally. And that in the face of other options that other immigrants have taken by pursuing legal channels to come to the United States, that perhaps, you know, not everything that your parents did should be lauded.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate you bringing up that point. And in my experience in the South Asian community in particular, there is some myth of meritocracy that we really just need to shatter with facts and opening our eyes. Okay, and what I mean by that is very few people get, relatively speaking, get to come to the United States the legal way and do all the right things. We hear this term, stand in line. Why won't they just stand online? The fact is, there are fewer and fewer lines to stand on, and many people don't have a line to stand on. My parents did what immigrants generations and generations before did. My parents did what, you know, Joe Biden's great-great-grandfather did. I was actually reading up on Biden's history a bit because I was watching him in the presidential debate, the last one. And it bothered me how he talks about immigrants at the border, because he talks about America as a place where, yes, if you are fleeing persecution, we should help you. But I found that to be a really narrow understanding about who belongs in America and what has fueled America up until now. And it turns out his own great-great-grandfather from Ireland, as Biden recounts it, was an adventurer. He was a seafaring adventurer. He was not fleeing from persecution. He was, you know, basically looking for experiences, landed in the U.S., became a shoemaker. And, you know, at the time of previous migrations, for example, the Ellis Island immigrants, about a third of the U.S. can trace their heritage to the Ellis Island immigrants. So earlier 1900s, which is actually not that long ago. What was the average wait time for those Ellis Island immigrants when they were trying to come into America and be American? Well, according to the archives of that museum, the average wait time was 3 to 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not years. Hours. And so what's happened in our country is that we've made it harder and harder and harder for the very thing that gives America its identity, its life force, which is the immigrant. We've made it harder for that person to come in and be part of who we are. And that's not an enormous gap, by the way, between the law and our culture. Mm-hmm. Our culture is open. Meghna, you know, wherever you travel, you and I both travel a lot. You ever look up restaurants when you're traveling, whatever corner of the country you are in? What I notice when I go on my Google Maps and I look up my restaurants, I've got every nationality popping up at me. Vietnamese here, Thai here, Indian here, Salvadorian here. And it's all within a mile of each other. That tells you who we are as a culture. Let food be our guide. And what the laws say are another thing, but that's also just because we have misguided politicians.
Mm. Well, I do want to hear from you about the beating heart of this book, which was what happened to your father. But Aarti, we've got some callers who have
great
personal experiences to share with us. So let me just at least bring one of them in. Myra is calling from Miami, Florida. Myra, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me. You know, it's funny. I've been a green card holder for about 15 years. And when you asked, you know, if we feel confident, I went, huh, maybe I don't. Maybe there's always this kind of cloud of anxiety about it, whether it's because you don't understand your rights completely, if they can just sort of be taken away. I'm not sure, but there is certainly a cloud of mystery. And I was just, I'm trying to get a name change, something as simple as a name change on my card. And it's been 7 months and it feels arbitrary. It feels like you don't have full authority of the situation. It's certainly made up to make us feel uncomfortable and somehow insecure, but the system doesn't make us feel fully solid on our immigration status, and that's kind of sad.
Yeah, well, Myra, thank you so much for your call. Aarti, would you like to respond to her?
Yeah, you know, Myra, thank you for calling. And I don't know your own backstory. Certainly having a green card makes you more secure than being undocumented. But part of what I'm doing in my memoir, Here We Are, is tracking how the value of the green card really plummeted. And having that legal status means a lot less than it used to. And that is not because of changes under Donald Trump, by the way. That's because of changes that happened under President Bill Clinton in the 1990s. My family was at the forefront of a new trend in American history. That new trend is delegalization, meaning, you know, as was in my father's case and the case of many people I've met along the way, you can have your green card. You can have kids who are U.S. citizens, a spouse who's a U.S. citizen. But if you have any kind of run-in with the law, I mean, I'm talking about misdemeanors as well. I'm talking about things that don't even carry any jail time, just about any kind of interaction with the criminal justice system. And you are flung into a proceeding that is, by the way, it's not a criminal proceeding. It's a civil proceeding. You have no public defender. And the laws which Clinton passed, signed, are such that you cannot ask a judge to look at you and consider your life and weigh whether or not you should be deported. It is an automatic system. And so in a lot of ways, what I'm tracking is, in Here We Are, how the U.S. built a mass deportation system. We've heard the term mass incarceration. We know what it means. I think we now need to wrap our heads around how that's extended for immigrants into mass deportation.
So, Arthi, it's now time to hear more about what happened to your father, right? Because, as you're saying, with the arrival of the green card, it was supposed to confer a level of security to really pursue that American dream, which your family did until disaster completely struck. How did he end up getting arrested?
Yeah. And, you know, I want to just sort of share one thing with you. It's funny because, you know, it's not just Dad had a green card. He and I both just had green cards, you know, but we just assumed we're American.
Yeah.
And neither of us had naturalized yet, while the other members of our family already had. Maybe we were, you know, not as good at doing paperwork and bureaucracy as they were. And I remember joking one day, and I kind of think about this joke a lot now. I joke, well, we have green cards. It's the same as being a U.S. citizen, only we can't vote. That's the only difference. And since most Americans don't vote, there's not really any difference. And, you know, I hope that increasingly that is not the case and Americans do vote. But anyway, what happened with Dad is he ran a shop on 28th Street and Broadway in Manhattan. His little brother helped him run the shop. It was his American dream. I mean, he wanted to be a small business owner. That is hard work. And he ran a small margins business. He sold watches and calculators and keyboards. This was before the era of the smartphone, making very little profit on each sale with a very, very big rent to pay in Manhattan. So anyway, it was a wholesale store selling bulk purchases. And according to New York State, one of the many buyers who came to the store seeking to purchase electronics were members of the Cali drug cartel. So in the indictment, Dad was accused effectively of being a front for the most notorious cartel at that time in the entire country.
This is so wild. It's such a wild story. And keep going, Arthi. Go ahead.
And it's funny because Dad would always say, I don't get it. I'm doing what everyone's doing. I don't get it. And in part, it didn't really matter. Because once you're ensnared in a case, you don't point fingers and say, hey, I'm just doing the industry standard. This is the norm. It doesn't work that way unless you're a multi-billion dollar company. Unless you're one of the companies I cover, it doesn't work that way. Okay. The reality for most business owners is different from the reality for, you know, the big tech giants, for example.
But let me ask you, did he, when he said everyone's doing it, does that mean that he knew he was selling to them or that
no,
he didn't?
What he meant, excuse me, thank you for asking me that. What he meant by that is he was selling bulk purchases of electronics, again, the watches and the calculators, for cash. That's what he was doing. So these were cash transactions. And that's what everybody in the district was doing. Were his customers also customers at other shops? They could be. They might not be. But everyone in that district had the same practice, which is, oh, you want to come in and you want to buy, you know, 10,000 radios, because people were still buying radios at the time. You want to buy 10,000 radios and ship them to Colombia or Mexico or Johannesburg or wherever? Sure. Give us your cash. We'll send you the merchandise. And the one thing that Dad did not do, which he also said was the industry norm, is he did not ask the people who were purchasing these items for any of their own legal paperwork. Mm-hmm. For any kind of form. Because if you ask them that, they would say goodbye and then just go to the next store. So that's what he meant, what he was doing that everyone was doing. It was a cash business.
But he got arrested for it.
That's right. That's right. He got arrested for it. And this is kind of the really my lesson about how the criminal justice system works. I mean, it is so different from what you see on TV. It really is. Dad got arrested, and I remember going to his first court case. And at the time, I was actually I was a scholarship kid at the Brearley School in Manhattan, okay? I was already dealing with plenty of imposter syndrome, with trying to fit in a very elite world. Going to Brearley was the first time I was surrounded by totally, like, white people. It was all white people. It was basically very few people of color, culturally incredibly jarring. And the people at Brearley, you know, their dads were CEOs and surgeons and professors. And I couldn't, you know, I had already felt self-conscious that, oh, my family's small time. We run a shop. It's very manual labor. Sometimes on the weekends, we're packing and unpacking boxes. I'm not going to fancy places. So I couldn't tell people at school that, for example, I need to miss a day of class because I need to go to Queens Criminal Courthouse for Dad's hearing. Yeah.
Well, we'll take a quick break here and pick up the story when we come back. We're talking with Aarti Shahani. She's NPR's correspondent in Silicon Valley, but she's out with a new memoir called Here We Are, and we'll hear more of this incredible story when we get back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Aarti Shahani. She's NPR's correspondent in Silicon Valley. But we're talking to her because she's written a beautiful new memoir. It's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And it is her family's immigration story and how even after getting green cards, the security that's supposed to come with the ability to pursue your American dream may be a little bit out of reach, and she's telling us the story of what happened to her father. So, Aarti, why don't you pick up where you left off? Because your father got arrested, your uncle got deported in the same case, right? And your father was threatened with deportation as well. I mean, what happened to him in the course of his case being heard?
Yeah, so this is what happened. My father and uncle were brought into court. Their lawyer suggested they plead guilty. Mr. Shahani, you'll do 8 months. Put it behind you. If you go to trial, the lawyer said, you could serve more than a decade. That's because of the trial penalty. Exercising your constitutional right to trial is not free of charge. If you are convicted, you will spend a very long time in prison. They took the plea. They couldn't afford this kind of risk. And so my uncle went in first. And here is what's to me so fascinating about, you know, acting like my dad and uncle were these big-time drug dealers and our store was just a front for a drug cartel. That was what the prosecutor treated us like at the beginning of the case. But then when it came to securing that guilty plea, because the prosecutor really wanted that guilty plea secured, the prosecutor agreed to let one man go in first and then let the other man go in. So Uncle Ruthven, my uncle, served his time. Then he would come out, run our store, and then Dad would serve his time. Now, Meghna, you know, one thing that I would just point out is if these were some big-time drug dealers and our store was a front for a cartel, why would you structure a plea deal so that the store can keep running and the family can keep surviving off of their business? I mean, it was total bogus. My uncle went in, and because of a mistake by New York State made an error, he ended up serving 2.5 years instead of 8 months. He really suffered. And the day we thought he was coming home, I mean, we were ready for the welcome home party, and it turned into a search party because we had no idea deportation was going to be the second surprise punishment after he had already served his time. He disappeared. For 4 days, we had no idea where he was. And then my uncle called us. He was in a different prison, a detention center, that happened to be – this was like – you know, life is so weird. The prison he was in happened to be just across the street from my favorite club in New York City. Like, as a kid, I would go underage clubbing at the spot called SOB, Sounds of Brazil. And my uncle was being detained at 201 Varick Street, right across the street from there. And my world was falling apart. I mean, that's really when the shame that I felt around the arrests, it just shattered. And what I felt was indignation. I just felt like enough is enough. How much are we going to keep paying for this? And unfortunately, you know, I was a student at that point at the University of Chicago. I flew home and I was trying to make sense of how we could build a defense and save my uncle. And, you know, we just had all these common sense notions about the law, like, hey, he had a first time nonviolent offense. Hey, he's a family man. Hey, we have a small business. Hey, a bunch of us are U.S. citizens and green card holders. That must all count for something. But as a matter of fact, under the law, it didn't count for anything. And he was basically summarily deported. And then my father's case followed his case.
And your father served time in Rikers, right?
Correct.
And you had said earlier in the show that in a way, a lot of your relationship with him was built around your visits to him at Rikers. Those conversations, did he ever, in his time in prison, did he ever indicate to you that his view about his adopted country, about America, did it change?
Of course it did. Rikers.
Here's why I ask. Yeah. I ask because, yes, of course, you're in prison for having run a store. But I guess I'm just asking that because the drive that immigrants have to come to the United States produces in many of them, speaking from personal experience in my family, a kind of profound love for this country that is almost immune sometimes to seeing the incredible downsides. Now, it's hard to be immune to it and you're in prison, but I'm just wondering, like, he felt his love for America be tested, I guess.
Here's what happened, okay? In my book, you know, so here we are and there's a subheading, right? American dreams, American nightmares. And that is the full breadth that my family has experienced in this country. When my father went to Rikers Island, I mean, he had a hard time talking about what he was seeing in there. He was a quiet man and preferred not to share the kinds of violence he was seeing in there. But he was absolutely, you know, his first night there, a fellow prisoner came up to him in the middle of the night and said, "Give me your wedding ring or I'm going to slice off your finger." And my father started screaming, "Get away from me, get away from me, get away from me." And thankfully, the guy didn't beat him up and didn't hurt him. But that was that was a pretty standard greeting there. And it's not just that it was violent for him, but he saw so many. I think what really changed for him when he got to Rikers Island is seeing, wow, this is a sea of black and brown faces. Practically every prisoner here is a person of color. You know, he asked me one day, I remember going to him, and he asked me, he's like, white people don't commit crimes? There are white people in New York. They don't commit crimes. And he wasn't, you know, he was trying to wrap his mind around the fact that the justice system is selective. It is racially focused and biased. And that's not something he really knew until he got there. And so I would say that the experience at Rikers Island opened his eyes to what being a quote-unquote criminal actually means. And often it's not an indictment on your actual character. It's a reflection of the society you live in and who gets targeted.
Mm. Well, let me just turn back to our callers for a moment, Aarti. Let's go to Wakita, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Wakita, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Doing all right. Go ahead.
Hi, Ms. Shahani. I just want to tell you that you're just really talking about something that I'm dealing with in my life right now. Two points that you made about your father being in prison, and the other one was someone near and dear to you guys that tried to basically extort you, use you for his own benefit. My husband is currently doing 4 years in prison because of a so-called friend. When my husband first came to the United States, he used my husband My husband is a native of Nigeria, and when he came here, he didn't know anyone. You know, he came here legally, he got a green card, and he had one person that he was familiar with from Nigeria here, and this guy used my husband. He implemented him into his dirty scheme of embezzling money. Mm-hmm. And my husband is now serving 4 years in prison, and he's facing being deported from the United States. Mm-hmm. So my question to Ms. Tahani is, how can I, as a person who knows nothing about law and who does not have money, how can I help my husband to stay in the United States?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for asking about that. There are sort of two things that come to mind. I don't want to be bleak. I am in general a hopeful person. The reality of the deportation system is that in most cases, it is automatic and mandatory. So there's not an opportunity to go before a judge and say, hey, this guy served his time. He's sorry. He doesn't need the second punishment. And please consider the impact on, for example, his children, if there are children, or his wife, as you are. There are a handful of nonprofits in this country that have really focused on this work. I can recall one right now. The Immigrant Defense Project, which is based in New York City, has been doing this valiant effort both in New York and around the country of helping people who are prosecutors and public defenders in the criminal justice system to understand how one case can be a pipeline into another because it's still poorly known. Yeah, but the reality is we need legal change. I recall before September 11th when I was a kid, I'd actually stopped going to college for a while because I needed to fight my dad's case. I needed to fight to keep my family together in this country. And when I stopped going to school so that I could be close to dad and I could go to Rikers, I also got involved in a political campaign. This was right before 9/11. And I remember in that campaign, there were Republicans. Like if you might recall Lamar Smith, the Republican from Texas, he was one of the members of Congress saying, oh, whoops, these deportation laws that we passed in 96 that Clinton signed, they went too far. We need to kind of undo some of this stuff. Mm. And unfortunately, after 9/11, that wisdom pretty much vanished in a moment of severe political opportunism. And, you know, I'm waiting and looking for the political leaders who have a conscience and who can break open the truth.
Right. Well, you know how you mentioned that you essentially put your college career on hold to help hold your family together and to come up with a new legal strategy for your father. You were successful in doing that, in finding a lawyer who could, as I read it, just sort of made a slightly different argument that helped your father regain his freedom, right?
Yeah, it's funny. The way that my father secured his temporary freedom, meaning the way that we got him out of immigration detention so that we could keep on fighting. I mean, this case lasted for a decade. Yeah. But that very important victory at the beginning, it happened because I found this genius attorney in Newark, New Jersey, who happened to constantly be reading new court cases and found this one precedent that was set, you know, literally a few days or weeks before my father was scheduled to go from one facility to another. And he ran into federal court with that precedent and made this incredibly sophisticated argument. Hey, court, the immigration authorities say Mr. Shahani must be deported, but he's not even deportable. And it was just like very intricate argument. I spell it out and here we are in the memoir because it fascinated me. It was such an insight to me into how law works. Law is not justice. It is the practice of finding and exploiting loopholes. Okay. Mm-hmm. That is what my family's experience taught me. And that lawyer, incredibly savvy, managed to wrench dad out of a system. And because my father was not locked up, we then had further fuel to keep on fighting. You know, and the immigration prosecutors, they know this. If you can keep somebody detained on the taxpayer dollar, it's a lot easier to get them ultimately deported. So it's, you know, it's an easier fight to win.
Mm. Arthur, your father has since passed away. This experience is obviously, it's so central to your life, his life, your whole family's life. Does anyone in your family, do you ever have conversations about whether, I mean, this is such a crazy question, but I got to ask it anyway. Does your mother ever wonder if coming to America was the right decision?
You know, it's funny because my mom, she sees what happened to her husband. And I think she carries with her a lot of guilt because she really wanted us to stay here. She really felt that this was a better country for girls, for women, for her, for us. And so Dad, you know, he didn't want to stay here, but he fought and he was the target and he fought for us. And she has that guilt for him. But then I know my mom, she looks at me and, you know, I am living her dream.
Yeah.
And I know that my mother looks at me. And, you know, it's funny. A lot of Indian moms would be very concerned to have a daughter like me. You know, I live a fairly unconventional life. I run around the country. I interview strangers. I go into strangers' homes and offices. And mom just finds my life to be incredibly exciting and meaningful. And she knows, and I know, and we all know, that is only possible here. It would not have happened, quote unquote, back home.
Your father must have seen that too.
Yeah, you know, I think he did. It's funny. There's a picture I have of him that's included in Here We Are. My publisher was like, hey, let's include a family photo album in the book. And it was funny because it's like, wow, I am really sharing my family story with my country. And we included in the photo album a picture of Dad at my graduation from Harvard. I went to graduate school at Harvard. And he is just sitting there. I mean, he just looks gangster. Like, he's got his sunglasses. He's got his ring. He's got his jacket on. He was by then in a wheelchair. He had been through a lot physically. But the smile on him and the sun shining on him. And, you know, that whole day, he's the one who held my diploma. You know, it was his.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got just a couple of seconds left to go, Arthi. And I want to say thank you so much for sharing your story. There's a lot of it that really hit me too, and the beauty with which you write it in the book is incredible. And we had a lot of callers that I couldn't get to who feel that fragility that you're talking about, and So, with that, I'm just gonna wrap up because I could talk with you for another hour about it, but we're just flat out of time. So
I'll find you, okay?
Please do. And in terms of Indian parents looking on their children living unconventional lives, join the club.
Auntie and uncle be proud of her.
Aarti Shahani is NPR's correspondent in Silicon Valley. Her new memoir is Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Aarti, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.